Brilliant. Thanks, Paul. It's great to see you all. Welcome, and good to see everybody. And we're, as Paul said, we're continuing the series in Genesis this week. This week we get to the flood, which is, of course, one of the most famous stories in the Bible, right? It's a story that we love to tell the kids. It's a great excuse to make lots of animal noises, to teach them what an aardvark is and all this kind of stuff, and we love it. But one of the things that strikes me is that I don't think we always tell the kids the story of the flood in exactly the same way that Genesis does. We often focus on Noah. What a great achievement, building such a big boat, the hours he spent nailing all the gopher wood together, whatever gopher wood is. We love to talk about the animals, you know, they're going in two by two and all this kind of stuff. We focus on what's going on inside the ark, you know, everyone snuggled up together in there. But as you read through the narrative in Genesis chapters 6 to 8, Genesis doesn't so much focus on Noah, but on God. And in fact, not so much what's going on inside the ark, but the destruction that's taking place outside the ark. So why is it that we tell the story differently? Well, I think because at its heart, the story of the flood is a story of judgment, and I think we find that hard. I don't know how you feel about it. I've always felt that there's a dark edge to this story, right? For those outside the ark, they're condemned. It's difficult. And so I think what we do when we tell it to the kids is we slightly sugarcoat it. You know, we retell it. We cut the bits that portray God as being judging, because we think that by doing that, we'll protect him from the accusation that in some way he is heartless. And so what we're left with is a story that doesn't tell us much about God and just looks like a bit of a weird lesson in zoology. And so what I want us to do today is try and think about the narrative of the flood as Genesis puts it to us. In particular, the question I want to ask is, what does this story tell us about the heart of God? And I think as we get into it, what we see is that far from being heartless, what we see here is a picture of God who is heartfelt, full of passion in the way that he views his people, his creation, and all that would spoil it. And I hope that we'll therefore get a snapshot of God's heart, and, you know, whether we've been a Christian for years or whether we're even quite cynical about Christian things, that we'll at least be able to respond to the God of the Bible as the scriptures present him, rather than that of the nursery. So what does this tell us about God? I think two big truths. I think it tells us that he has a heart that grieves at sin, but at the same time, he has a heart that is full of grace to his creation. And those are the two themes I sort of want to pull out as we go through. So firstly then, we see here God's grief at sin. And if the flood is at heart a story of judgment, God's heart behind that judgment is one of grief. He's not heartless, but this is a heartfelt judgment. So let's look at Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. We'll pick it up there. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. You see here God's grief at sin. And we can follow it through in three sections, in three sort of steps. The first is that God sees sin. Remember how back in Genesis chapter 1, as we saw God creating, he looked at the world and saw that everything was good. Now, what does he see as he looks at the world? Well, he sees that everything is, in some sense, rotten, tainted by sin. And there's a real emphasis on the totality of sin here. So look at verse 5 again of chapter 6. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that his every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry he had made man on the earth. Or again, look on to verse 11 there on the screen. Now the earth was corrupt in the God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, since the earth is filled with violence through them. Now you remember, humanity was supposed to fill the earth and multiply. And they filled the earth, all right, but they filled it with violence. And God sees this, and he sees the full extent. So last week we saw in Genesis chapter 4 that humanity's sin is not a blip. Adam and Eve in the garden, it's not a one-off. It's the pattern of humanity. Genesis chapter 6, what we see is that sin isn't limited to a few people. You know, as we've been through Genesis so far, we've seen the sin of individuals, of Adam and Eve, of Cain, of Lamech. But now we see it's all of humanity. In other words, it's not just them over there. It's all of us everywhere. And you get that sense here. Just everywhere God looks, things are rotten. Imagine, I don't know, someone coming back from having their home flooded. And as they come back, they take away the sandbags and they go into the house and everything is rotten. You know, the sofa's soaking wet. The floorboards are rotten through the skirting boards. Everything. Well, that is the sense here. Every intention of the heart, of the thoughts of man's hearts, is only evil continually. It is all rotten through. I remember when I was at school, when I was 7 or 8, there was a fire in the school. And every time you opened a book after that, for the next, I don't know, months, you would open it, you could smell the fire, the smoke from the books. That's the kind of sense here, that as God looks at the world, violence, sin, rottenness, it's pervading everything. And so this then is God's grief at sin. He sees it in its full extent. He sees sin where we don't. And this, I think, puts us at a profound tension with the society around us. Because we live in a society where when we do something wrong, we make excuses. Think about the kind of training courses we go on at work, sort of soft skills courses. A lot of the assumptions behind them all is that humanity is fundamentally good. I've got to dig within myself to find the good within me, to look inside myself, to believe in myself. We live at a kind of unique moment in history where if someone commits a crime, we often view the criminal as much of a victim as the person who's they've committed the crime against. You know, we say, well, there must have been something that turned him from being a good person to crime, something in his upbringing or the institutions that hold power over him. And God's verdict is a little bit different. He says, actually, there is a basic problem with humanity that we need to confront and not just try and ignore or sweep under the carpet. And so to have the heart of God is not to make light of wrongdoing or turn a blind eye to it, but to see it, to confront it, to confess it, to bring it out into the open and deal with it. And I think in some senses that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? I mean, we all know this, right? You know, think about our workplaces. If we try and build a workplace on the assumption that everyone we work alongside is perfect, it's not going to work out. We're going to end up disappointed pretty quickly. That's why pretty much every firm we work for will have some kind of grievance procedure in place. Things go wrong. We know that inherently. As we look within ourselves, yes, we saw in chapter 1, we're made in the image of God with all the dignity that comes with that. But at the same time, if we're honest, when we look within ourselves, we see wrongdoing. We see the jealousy that begrudges someone else their break at work, the greed that wants to use other people, the deceit that insists on imposing my narrative. So everything about our lives is tainted by wrongdoing. And so as Christians, we look to God not just to top up our inner spirituality, but for change. We need him to change us and lead us into his new kingdom, forgiven and transformed. And if this feels bleak, that God's verdict as he sees sin, well, I mean, in some ways it is, but let's not think that his attitude is one of rubbing our noses in it. Because if he sees sin, then we also see here really clearly that he grieves at sin. And again, I just want to come back to chapter 6, verse 5 again, verse 6. The Lord was sorry that he had made man on earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I'll blot out man I've created from the face of the land, man and animals, creeping things, birds of the heaven, for I'm sorry that I've made them. You sense the grief here. It's a bit like, I don't know, the curator of an art gallery, and there's been a fire. And once the fire engines go away, he walks through the gallery and looks at masterpiece after masterpiece, ruined on the floor, and that deep sense of sorrow. I think that's the picture here. God looks around this world that he's created, this beautiful world with its variety and its richness, with intimate human relationships, and he sees that it's filled with violence. And so he grieves, and rightly so. And actually, we do as well, if we're honest. I mean, Think about what's in the news right now. The awful things happening in the Ukraine, just the wanton destruction of human life. And it's not just the Ukraine. You think back a couple of weeks, the stories of young girls being trafficked for sex around the world, the story of that gymnast in Russia being reduced to tears by her coach. It's so wretched. And we grieve at wrongdoing. And actually, I think it's a relief that God does as well. He's not cold and dispassionate. He's not heartless. But he is heartfelt as he seeks to remove all wrongdoing from his creation. It's a good thing. One of the reasons I think we sort of struggle a bit with this is that in the UK, we separate out lawmaking from law enforcing. So a judge in this country is supposed to be cold and dispassionate. They don't make the rules. They simply have to go through, analyse and pronounce a sentence. And so when we hear talk of God judging, we assume that he's being cold and dispassionate, but that's not the case. God is the lawgiver and the law maker. His judgment is passionate and heartfelt. You know, human being, he wasn't moved to sorrow by evil. We would think of them as subhuman. Well, how much more God? So God is sorry. And I don't think this necessarily means he's surprised by what is happening, but he is grieved. So this then is telling us something quite deep about the heart of God, that when we picture God in our head, let's not think of a cold lawyer. Let's think perhaps more of a parent, loving and caring for their child. Which means that if I'm to see the world as God does, I need to see my sin not as the breaking of a rule, but in a sense the ruining of a masterpiece. And I guess there are times when we're only too aware of things in our lives that aren't right. We do something shameful, and we try and say to ourselves, oh, it's no big deal, you know, other people do things worse. But that voice, it doesn't satisfy, it doesn't ring true, it doesn't silence the sense of guilt and unease. In our workplaces, I think sometimes the stress of work will bring out the worst in us. And the scriptures will say we shouldn't bury that. If I'm to see my sin as God sees it, I need to grieve it and not just excuse it. I need to confess it and not just ignore it. Because God calls sin out into the open and he grieves over it. That's why, as Christians often, you know, when we gather in churches on a Sunday, we'll confess our sin together. That's a good thing to do. But funnily enough, it's Ash Wednesday today, isn't it? I don't know if you do Lent or not, but what's at the heart of the period of Lent is grieving over sin. You know, if someone in your office asks you, have you given up chocolate for Lent? Well, why not talk about Lent as a time not just simply for trying to give up sweet things, but actually for grieving over sin and how saddened we are by what's going on in the world? You never know, it might lead to a conversation. Here's God's grief at sin. But it's not a sort of hand-wringing, impotent sorrow. Because thirdly, we see here God judges sin. He sees it, he grieves over it, and he takes action. So let's look at chapter 6, verse 11. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight. The earth was filled with violence. God saw the earth, and behold, it's corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted their way in the earth. And God said, I've determined to make an end to all flesh. For the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. There's a bit of a play on words going on in Hebrew here. The word corrupt and the word destroy have the same root. So I think effectively what God is saying is the world has gone to ruin, so I'm going to ruin it. There's a kind of appropriateness here, a bit like being in the cinema and a drunk crowd come in and they start ruining the film. And so they're kicked out, it's ruined for them because they've been ruining it for everyone else. And so as the flood comes forth, you see God judging by really undoing his creation. Back in chapter 1, we saw him sort of taking the world from chaos and ordering it. Setting aside the waters, the rivers then coming up and watering the earth in chapter 2. And now all of that is taken away and there's this terrifying deluge as the waters break forth and the flood comes out. I mean, do you remember the storms we had just a couple of weeks ago? I don't know if you, I went out in the thick of, I can't remember if it was Eunice or the other one, but I went out in the thick of it. It was terrifying being beaten around by this wind, and suddenly you just feel very vulnerable, very flimsy as you're beaten around. That must have been what it was like to be there as God unleashed the waters of the world. And it is a total judgment. So we didn't read this, but if you were to look on to chapter 7, verse 21, it's just on the screen there. You get the sense of completeness of God's judgment here. I'll read from 21. All flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all the swarming creatures that swam on the earth, and all mankind, everything on the dry land, in whose nostrils was the breath of life, died. He blotted out every living thing. It's a complete judgment. There's no loophole. There's no favoritism. There's no platinum club membership that will get you through it. And so, you know, there is quite a stark warning here. When Jesus talks of the flood in Matthew 24, he uses it really as a picture of judgment to warn people that to stand before God unforgiven is terrifying, because God is passionate for his world. He will remove all evil from his world at the end of time. So God's heart is grief to sin. Well, at this point, we might say this all seems pretty bleak for Wednesday lunchtime. Where is the hope? Well, if we see God's grief at sin, we also see his grace to creation, primarily in his grace to Noah. I mean, this is at the heart a story of salvation, right? That's the bit I think that we tell the kids that we get right. There is Noah, and he's rescued. If the New Testament talks of the flood as a warning, it also talks of the flood as a picture of salvation. You see that in 1 Peter 3. The waters that come and judge the world are the waters that lift Noah up above the destruction. God is gracious to Noah. And there's a kind of symmetry here. God promises to destroy at the beginning of the story, and he promises to save at the end. They go into the ark, they come out of the ark, the waters burst forth, the waters recede, and in the middle of the story, the centerpiece is chapter 8, verse 1, where it simply says, God remembered Noah. That's the heart of the story. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that God's forgetful. It's going, flip, Noah, I forgot all about him. He's in there with the animals. It must be chaos. What it means is that God has set his love upon Noah. A bit like saying, you imagine someone from a normal birth who becomes really famous, I don't know, a pop star or something, and then they remember an old school friend in their will. It's that kind of sense. God chooses to save Noah. What's special about Noah? Well, I don't know much, really. Look at verse 8 of chapter 6, which is told God found favor in the eyes of the Lord. We're not told he won favor. Found favor. So before he's been to B&Q or measured off a piece of wood or overcome his fear of spiders, before he's given the dimensions of the ark, we're told that Noah found favor with God. You know, we tell the story of Noah to the kids, making a big deal about him building the ark. And Genesis doesn't do that. It's about God, and God chooses to have favor. All we're told about Noah is that he does exactly what God commanded him to. So when it says that he's righteous or blameless, I don't think that means that he's sinless. We look at the book of Hebrews, I think it simply means that he has faith. God offers him a rescue and he takes hold of it. Like someone sort of being lifted out from a flood who grabs a hold of the rope coming down from the helicopter. That is what Noah does, he has faith. If judgment is fearsome, here is a picture of the way out of it. It's by faith in God. So Noah is not saved by his power tools or by his good deeds, but because God chooses to save him. So this is God's grace to Noah. And it gives us a picture of faith, of where our hope lies in the face of our own wrongdoing or the brokenness of our society or indeed the horrors of war. Throughout history, humanity's faced two choices. Where do we put our confidence in the face of wrongdoing? Well, we can put it in ourselves, in humanity, in humanism. We can trust ourselves to live a better life. We can excuse ourselves by comparing ourselves to others. We can look within for a deeper sense of enlightenment. Or I can look to God. I can look to his forgiveness, to his favor, to his blessing. And the heart of God is to give grace to individuals who seek his mercy. We see that in God's grace to Noah. I think we also see it, by the way, in his grace to the whole of creation. You know, we're told repeatedly it's all the animals, the whole of creation is wiped out. But then the whole of creation is also in the ark. And here's the thing that's slightly quirky, and this is where we'll land it. The thing that's odd about the flood is that at the beginning, we're told that every inclination of mankind's heart is evil all of the time. Let's look at verse 8, chapter 8, verse 21, at the end. And just at the end of the flood story, here's what we're told. God says, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. So that's really interesting. After the flood, God is still saying humanity is evil, and yet I'm going to have mercy and not flood the earth. So here is a great tension that runs through this story. On the one hand, humanity is evil and God must judge it. On the other hand, God's heart is one of love for his creation, and so he acts to save. And so here are the two themes that run through the flood: God's grief at sin and God's grace. He must judge because humanity is sinful, and yet he has grace in spite of humanity's sin. How can that tension be reconciled? Well, that is ultimately what drives us through to the cross, because it's not until the Lord Jesus comes and dies on the cross in our place for our sin that if we're trusting in him, we see God's grief at sin. He won't just ignore sin, he judges it. Jesus pays the penalty, and yet God's grace to sinners, his love that by faith in him we might stand forgiven. So that is the heart of God, and it drives us to the cross. Where are we left? Well, the question is, will we have the faith that Noah has? For him, that was faith in building an ark. For us, it is taking a hold of the cross. That as we go back to work this afternoon and we confront the rottenness around us and the rottenness in our own hearts, am I going to try and just work my way out of it? Or am I going to take hold of the cross and Jesus' forgiveness and praise God? Be thankful for him, but praise him that his passion for justice is greater than ours, that his love for people is greater than ours, and that his heart is bigger than we can fathom. Human sinfulness and rottenness is a terrible thing. We'll confront that this afternoon. But God's heart.